More Arizonans are living in areas with high poverty rates than a decade ago, and the state has one of the highest such concentrations in the country. A main culprit seems to be the Great Recession.
We're seeing more people in suburbs. What have previously been healthy communities are now sort of slipping into poverty.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Ahead on the show, along with our partners from the world, we'll bring you the latest national and international news and keep you up to date on Arizona, including an increase in poverty areas.
Also, a Mesa intersection will be getting a makeover.
Is Arizona becoming more small business friendly? And what's it going to take to put LeBron James in a Suns uniform?
I don't know if I'd say one in a million. I do think what's going to happen is things are going to have to fall apart with Miami.
Plus, picking up a pet to go with your new couch, and it's July 4th, so we promise some fireworks.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's July 4th, a holiday where we celebrate independence and the creation of a democratic nation. Democratic and stable are adjectives the U.S. hoped would describe Iraq after the U.S. invasion there. And many Iraqis imagined that after all they went through, they'd end up with a peaceful nation. Right now, though, that seems very far off. The militant Sunni group ISIS, or the Islamic State, as it now wants to be known, has been steamrolling across large parts of Iraq and killing people in its path. Today, we turn to David Patel to help us reflect on what's happening there. He's a Middle East scholar at Brandeis University, and he spent a lot of time living and studying in Iraq. He told me that for someone like him, what's been happening there comes as little surprise.
I think a lot of Americans had tuned out of what was happening in Iraq for the past couple of years. I think the Arab Spring and events elsewhere in the Middle East had taken over, in general, burnout of what was happening. But those of us who are still focused on Iraq, things have been getting very bad for a long time now. Since 2009, 2010, there's been a steady decline in security in many parts of Iraq, and violence was off the charts for the past year. So this attention is now back on Iraq because of ISIS, but things have been very bad there for quite some time now.
Now, we have this group ISIS, or the Islamic State. They're kind of making their way, pushing their way south in a very violent, brutal way. They're edging toward Baghdad. They're near one of cities, Samarra, that has sacred sites. And I know these Shia sacred sites are something you've written a lot about. Tell us about these sacred sites and why they're so important.
Well, there's four major ones for Shias in Iraq. The two major ones are south of Baghdad in the Shia heartland, Najaf and Karbala. And those are really the central shrines and contain the graves of the two most important figures in post-Muhammad Shia history. The one that's most threatened right now, though, is Samarra, which is up north. It's between Tikrit and Baghdad. And so it's really on the front lines of this ISIS-Iraqi government confrontation. And so one way of thinking about ISIS targeting the shrines is actually taking over territory that includes the shrines. Samarra is right in there, is right in that category now. The other way of being a target are attempts by ISIS to blow up the shrine or attack the shrine in order to start a sectarian war, which is their goal. They've said that's their goal. Their predecessor organizations in Iraq made that their goal and achieved it back in February 2006 when they attacked that shrine in Samarra in February of that year. So one is them trying to take over territory that happens to include those shrines. The second is actually targeting those shrines in order to provoke retaliation on Sunnis within the country.
Now, let's go to Samarra. Take us there. If we went to Samarra today, to this shrine, what would we see and who would be there?
Well, I imagine what you'd see would be tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers and volunteers, probably many of them Shias from outside Iraq as well, guarding the shrine and trying to prevent ISIS.
And what is
ISIS.
The shrine? What would we see?
So you'd see a giant gold dome over a tomb. And so in Samarra, it's called the Askariya Shrine, and it contains the graves of two of the 12 imams, the 10th and 11th imams. And next to it is also a place where the 12th imam, the Mahdi, the Messiah, went into occultation, where he removed himself from earth. He's not dead, so it's not his grave. And so this is really core for Shia belief. This is where the Mahdi left earth. And everything in Shia politics today is about how you govern the world in the absence of this just ruler, the Mahdi, right? The Iranian government is based on the idea that the cleric should be running thing until he returns. This site is inextricably linked to the Mahdi and to those two of those 12 other imams.
Okay, take us further south then to Najaf and Karbala. What are the shrines there and what do pilgrims do when they go?
Oh, it's an amazing experience. So those shrines in Najaf and Karbala, where the most venerated imams are buried, those were the commemorations of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who died in 680. It's really, that moment is really central for what it means to be a Shia. Let me take you to Karbala. The two enormous shrines, about a football-sized field each, with a large open space between them. And the shrines have a huge gold dome over a very elaborate sarcophagus with gold plating, silver plating all around it. And people will be running back and forth, large pilgrimages groups. You'll hear people speaking Arabic, but different Arabic accents, some Lebanese, some Iraqi accents, some Bahraini accents. You'll see Iranians there speaking Farsi. There'll be Indian pilgrims there. There'll be pilgrims from Detroit, Michigan, from Nigeria, visiting these shrines. And when you go into the building themselves, the emotion that people have is just simply overwhelming.
And is it men and women or just men?
Men and women both, but they'll be segregated in separate areas. And so I've been in the areas with the men. And what you really are overcome by is the grief and the empathetic experience of solidarity that these pilgrims have with the imam's pain. And these are grown men who've fought in a number of wars, who've worked their whole lives, working class and rich side by side, wailing hysterically oftentimes.
Really?
Absolutely.
Are there certain kind of smells and feel that you feel when you go to these shrines, or incense?
Incense, certainly. But since 2003, the number of people has just been overwhelming. These cities have been booming. This is, aside from Kurdistan, this is probably the area that has grown and developed the most.
This is Najaf and Karbala.
Najaf and Karbala.
Give me a sense of if ISIS or Islamic State, if they attacked one of these shrines, say in Najaf or Karbala, I mean, is it conceivable that that could happen?
Well, in February 2006, the way they were able to blow up a large part of the shrine in Samarra were insurgents, Al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time. At the time, they called themselves Al-Qaeda in the Land of the Two Rivers, the predecessor of ISIS. They snuck some guys in dressed in Iraqi military uniforms, and they got in there, tied up the Iraqi police and soldiers guarding the shrine and planted the bombs. So they were able to infiltrate it. And I think the fear is with so many volunteers coming, with so many people, so many militias, and so many clerics and political organizations around Iraq sending militias and volunteers there to quote-unquote defend the shrine, the fear is that ISIS will be able to sneak in some suicide bombers or some people with bombs posing as defenders of the shrine. And so I think that among Shia groups that are defending the shrines now, that's the real concern.
As Iraq moves forward, here we are on July 4th, celebrating the independence of a nation, and we kind of have some clear boundaries of what that nation is. If you could imagine a future Iraq that might be celebrating its own independence or its own new future, what do those borders look like?
I think it's hard to have a conversation about what the future borders of Iraq will look like without looking at the larger regional picture. This conflict that's going on, and I say this conflict because now the conflicts in Syria and Iraq have merged, I think this is going to go on for at least another decade. And so I think we need to ask this question again in a decade. If Syria will still have the same borders it has, if Iraq will still have the same borders that it has, if what Kurdistan looks like, the entire political order in the Middle East in many ways is being challenged by what's going on right now.
David, I know you spent a lot of time in Iraq living there and studying there. Who in Iraq are you thinking about?
Today in particular, I'm thinking about a friend, Ghufran Ahmed. He's probably about 39, 40 years old now. I don't remember exactly when his birthday was. He lived in Mosul, doesn't come from a wealthy family, but he was able to come to the United States, get a master's in archaeology from Stony Brook, and he went back and was teaching at Mosul University after 2009, teaching prehistory. He's Iraq's first prehistorian. And he had to flee Mosul when ISIS took over. He, his wife, and his two daughters are now in Iraqi Kurdistan. He's stuck there. He doesn't know anyone there. He doesn't have any connections, and he can't return home. If he does, he'll be killed almost immediately. So I'm thinking an awful lot about Ghufran today, not just about where he is today, but what the next decade of his life is going to look like and his daughters' lives.
That's David Patel, a research fellow at the Crown Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University. Another place where the U.S. has devoted considerable energy is Israel and the Palestinian territories. Things aren't going very well there either at the moment. Today, angry crowds gathered for the funeral of a 16-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Abu Khadir. Palestinians say he was killed in revenge for the murder of three Israeli teenagers who'd been hitchhiking in the West Bank. The Israeli government is hunting for the killers of those three boys, and it blames Hamas. Hamas officials have denied involvement, but at the same time, they've praised the killers. That may say something about Hamas's position now, caught between maintaining its reputation as a resistance force and not stirring up trouble with Israel. Daniela Cheslow reports from Hebron.
Israel has named two murder suspects. One is Marwan Kawasme. His extended family is one of Hebron's largest and has long had ties to Hamas. Israel has killed 9 Kawasmes for militant activity. The Israeli army says Marwan Kawasme, 29, is part of this tradition. He's been jailed 5 times, and they say he's admitted to being a member of Hamas and using the caves around Hebron for militant training. On Monday, the Israeli army blew up Marwan's home, part of a 4-apartment complex in Hebron. His sister, Rawan, walked through the wreckage with me this week.
There was a fire here, and it went on for a long time. They refused to remove all the gas canisters, and so everything exploded.
The fire destroyed the upstairs apartments of Marwan's brothers, Bilal and Sharif. The ceilings were held up by rusted metal pipes, which Rawan says the Hebron municipality brought over this week. The Kawasmes are furious that 16 people in their family are now homeless. But they also believe it's impossible that Marwan was involved in the murder of the three Israelis. His sister, Rawan, says there's no proof. And he wouldn't do it.
Marwan got married. He has a wife. His wife is pregnant. It's impossible that he would do this now. Marwan is not a member of Hamas.
I ask about the green Hamas flag flying on the roof.
We're not Hamas. Some young lads came and put the flags on our house, and we don't know it. We don't know why they did that.
Another relative, Mohammed Kawasme.
In Hebron, people believe that the kidnapping has not taken place. This is all political maneuvering on the part of the Israelis.
The Israeli army says it hasn't released all the evidence that points conclusively to Kawasme. Even so, they say, why else would he and his fellow murder suspect, Amr Abu Aisha, have disappeared since the kidnapping? Israeli officials have said, regardless of who murdered the teens, they hold the Islamic militant group Hamas responsible. And Hamas will pay for the crime. Since the kidnapping, Israel has arrested hundreds of Hamas members, including 12 legislators. But Hebron University political scientist Assad El-Awewi says it's not so far-fetched that Hamas had no knowledge of the attack.
What could have happened is that a group is creating mutiny against Hamas, a group that is splitting from Hamas and that is cooperating with groups that are more extreme.
El-Awewi says the kidnapping is bad for Hamas. The group was bouncing back after years of being ostracized and underfunded and recently ended a 7-year rift with its rival faction Fatah. And, El-Awewi says, Hamas was actually looking forward to a period of calm to rebuild itself. But now, Hamas is in a bind. It doesn't want to claim responsibility for murders it didn't carry out. But the leadership can't condemn the killings either.
If Hamas were to condemn this act, it would lose its popular support. Hamas basically is a resistance movement and always moves in that direction. Hence, it cannot condemn.
Thousands of demonstrators converged on a cemetery in East Jerusalem today to bury 16-year-old Mohammed Abu Khadir. He was allegedly kidnapped and murdered by Jewish Israelis in retaliation for the 3 slain Jewish teens. Hamas has fired dozens of rockets from Gaza over the past week, and Israel has responded with punishing airstrikes. Both sides have vowed revenge, although they also pledge to uphold a ceasefire as long as the other side does. For The World, I'm Daniela Cheslow, Hebron, the West Bank.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. And with our partners from the world, we'll bring you the latest national and international news and keep you up to date on Arizona. Coming up, a Mesa intersection readies itself for a makeover.
This is a former Motorola campus. It was just a blank slate. So to have very functional, very good-looking product up, I think just in terms of aesthetics, it will change the way that that area looks.
That and more ahead on the show.
Next week, when Congress comes back from the July 4th recess, the White House is expected to ask for more funding to address the flood of unaccompanied child migrants coming to the border. Many expect the president to request Congress to make changes to how children from Central America are processed so they can be deported more quickly. But that has some legal advocates worried, and joining us now to explain is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, following the story, a big issue is, do any of the kids who are coming actually have the legal right to stay here?
Yeah, and that's really the big question here. Are these refugees deserving of protection? Are these illegal border crossers who need to be sent back? We've seen that this has become a really polarizing issue with the protests we've seen in Murrieta. This is a big issue. According to the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, they did a study about 400 kids in this position and concluded that 58% of them qualified for protection under international standards.
So, Jude, what is there in U.S. law that would legally allow them to stay?
So there are a few different forms of relief that these unaccompanied children could potentially qualify for. So there's asylum. There's also if they've been trafficked or if they're a victim of a crime, there are visas for that. And then there's something called special immigrant juvenile status. And that's if for children who've been neglected or abandoned by their parents. And that's actually a two-step process because they have to formally go through something at the state court level before they're even eligible to apply for something like that. One would really need advice of counsel in order to navigate that.
At the same time, there is a tension. The more children we allow to stay, the more will want to come and make the dangerous trip. And that's one of the issues the White House is dealing with, how to stem that flow. So, Jude, what can we expect to hear from President Obama after July 4th?
Coming back from the July 4th recess, we know that President Obama sent a letter last week indicating that he plans to ask Congress for more funding to address this issue and that he wants to speed up the process for removal proceedings for this population. Some White House officials did tell USA Today that one of the proposals is to treat these Central American kids more like the way Mexican kids are treated, because there's the difference right now under the law. And they're asking, potentially going to ask for more flexibility to return them more quickly the way we currently do with Mexican children. And that involves a process where Border Patrol plays a role screening some of the children to see if they have credible fear or not to return.
So what sort of reaction has there been to the proposal?
It's been mixed. I mean, there's certainly people on different sides of the debate who have different opinions, of course. I spoke with an immigration attorney here in Phoenix, Ruben Reyes. He was concerned if a screening by Border Patrol plays a big role in determining what path a child gets and whether or not they end up seeing an immigration judge, for example, that could be tricky because sometimes kids aren't that forthcoming with their story and they might not exactly express themselves. Here he is.
They are children. They are oftentimes coming in as victims. So what they say to a Border Patrol officer in terms of why they came here, you know, maybe because they want to be tough, maybe because they don't want to expose what's happened to them recently or in their home country, could really affect what their relief is in immigration court.
And he says in his experience talking to these kids, sometimes they don't even realize some of the violence they've endured or the abuse they've endured is even remarkable because it's just their normal circumstance. So they might not always be their own best advocates in a situation where they haven't necessarily talked to an attorney already. We are going to know a lot more, at least, about what the Obama administration is proposing come next week.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Arizona saw an almost 10% increase in the number of residents living in poverty areas between 2000 and 2010. That's according to new numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau. Poverty areas are defined as having poverty rates of 20% or higher. In 2010, about a third of Arizonans lived in poverty areas, and almost two-thirds of people living in poverty lived in such areas. Cynthia Zwick, executive director of the Arizona Community Action Association, says the numbers aren't surprising.
What we're seeing in Arizona is that poverty continues to climb. We're the fifth highest state for poverty in the country. We have a 19% poverty rate. And so what we see is a couple of things, that the demographics are changing a bit in that we're seeing more people in suburbs. What have previously been healthy communities are now sort of slipping into poverty, and the condensation of communities of poor people. So there's a more density of certain areas of poor people living together.
Why is there more poverty in Arizona now than there was a few years ago, or even in 2010 when the Census Bureau last looked at this?
Largely, it's because of the recession. So while we're hearing a lot of talk about the fact that, you know, Arizona's recovering and things are looking better for the economy, in fact, there are a lot of people who are not yet recovering from the recession.
One of the things that the Census Bureau looked at was these poverty areas, these areas where there's a large percentage of folks who are living below the poverty line. And in Arizona, 64% of people who are in poverty are living in one of these poverty areas. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that communities are not thriving, and it tells me that more and more people are looking to find places where they can afford to live.
The Census Bureau noted that a lot of these poverty areas, especially in the West, tended to be around American Indian reservations. Are there particular challenges in dealing with poverty close to reservations?
Well, I think there are challenges dealing with poverty throughout the state, unfortunately. But typically on American Indian reservations, there have typically been very high poverty rates. So even during times that were better for the state, there were still poverty rates around 40%. You know, if you've been to some of the Native American communities, you know that unemployment is high, and there aren't as many opportunities for employment on the reservations. So the communities near them tend to be very rural. Tend to be lower wage employment opportunities as well. Transportation is an issue in those communities, so you have to have a vehicle in order to get around, and it just creates a number of barriers.
So as a state, then, what do we do? I mean, how do we try to reverse some of these trends of increased poverty?
Well, I think there are a couple of areas where we need to be focusing our resources. Education is clearly an area where we need to be supporting and making equal access to good education available. Livable wage jobs is another area. We need to make sure that there are safety net programs available. You know, and one of the things that we know about Arizona as well is that there's this sort of American dream that you'll do better than your parents have done and you'll continue to succeed. But in Arizona, and actually nationally, what we're knowing is that your parents' income is a great predictor of what your income will be. So as poverty continues to grow in Arizona and across the country, if we're not able to change the wage structure, we're not able to change some of the system supports, those families are never going to be able to climb out.
Kind of a vicious cycle.
It's a vicious cycle, and it's in part how we're seeing the sort of the income inequality gap gets greater and greater.
Cynthia Zwick is executive director of the Arizona Community Action Association.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. Quick check of Valley traffic. An accident I-10 eastbound at the I-17 stack has the exit ramp restricted. As far as Valley weather is concerned, it's possible we'll have a repeat of last night's activity. We'll have a chance for blowing dust and a 30% chance for rain tonight with lows in the mid-80s. And for this weekend, look for highs to warm to around 104 both tomorrow and Sunday. Currently partly cloudy and 93 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by The Persian Room, health-conscious Persian cuisine for lunch and dinner, plus catering for your special occasions and business events. The Persian Room on Scottsdale Road, one light north of Bell, 480-614-1414.
Valley developers are planning two warehouse buildings in Mesa, and they're operating on the if-you-build-it, they-will-come theory. The project is being built on spec. It'll join an existing development which features office and warehouse space.
In many ways, the intersection of Broadway and Dobson and Mesa looks like a lot of alley intersections. Gas stations, strip malls on the corners. But on the northwest corner, it's fenced in. You can't see inside right now. That, however, could be changing.
Our vacancy rate is just below 7% out in the Southeast Valley. So if you take that into account and really start digging into, you know, what we need out that way, this is exactly the type of product that we'd be looking for.
Steve Larson handles industrial brokerage in the Southeast Valley for the commercial real estate firm Jones Lang LaSalle.
It's more functional. The location is fantastic. We're close to a lot of retail amenities. And then obviously you're at the crux of all of those freeways with the US 60, the 101 and the 202.
There are other buildings that I imagine look fairly similar to what the developers are envisioning for the new buildings there. So it looks like sort of low-slung kind of larger buildings that have other tenants in them. Does having that kind of tenant, that kind of development in that neighborhood, will it do anything for that neighborhood, that Broadway-Dobson area?
Absolutely. If you drive through there, you're already seeing a lot of that be rejuvenated. You're seeing a lot of different developments and, you know, more rejuvenation to the area along with the retail that's going on. These people that are going to be working there are going to be looking for places to go for lunch, places to run errands to, things like that. So I believe that this is going to bring a lot more than just the simple warehouse jobs that are going to be there.
Well, you see more based on this new development. I mean, because as we said, there are already a lot of folks working in that area. There are already a bunch of buildings in there. And it doesn't look, at least a quick drive-by, it didn't look like there were a ton of, as you said, places to eat lunch, things like that right around. Will this new development, do you think, change that significantly?
I think a lot of the retail development that's currently existing, that's not going to change. We're not going to see a big retail power center go in just because these couple of buildings are going up. And that's very indicative of the different projects around the market. But you will see, this is a former Motorola campus. It was just a blank slate. So to have very functional, very good-looking product up, I think just in terms of aesthetics, it will change the way that area looks.
Would you expect that the companies that move into these buildings will be companies that are new to the Valley or new to the Mesa, the East Valley area, or might they be companies that are already there that are just looking for a new facility?
You'll probably have a combination of both. If you look at spaces that are, you know, 30,000 square feet and up, where a lot of these companies that are going to be coming in from out of town are going to be looking for, the availability is very small. So you'll see a combination of both. But I would say the bulk of the new the tenants to this project will be existing throughout the airport in the Southeast Valley.
So we're not necessarily looking at new companies, new jobs coming to the area, maybe some expansion perhaps?
That would probably be my guess. Is you may get, you know, another very large company like an Avial or, you know, a Braun Ability from out of Arizona. But my guess is that the bulk of them will be local currently, or at least have an operation currently here in Phoenix.
Steve Larson handles industrial brokerage in the Southeast Valley for the commercial real estate firm Jones Lang LaSalle.
Your level of friendliness can be measured by how much you smile or how willing you are to help someone out. From a small business standpoint, though, friendliness has more to do with taxes and regulations.
For the third year, the online market service company Thumbtack has teamed up with the Kauffman Foundation to figure out which cities and states are doing the best jobs of making small businesses comfortable. The study measured 11 categories.
But Chief Economist John Lieber says the businesses surveyed found some were more important than others.
Definitely the case. Some categories had a larger effect on overall perceptions of friendliness than others. So it turns out the three biggest categories that we graded were the ease of complying with licensing rules. So how easy is it to get a license? How easy is it to maintain your license? How well enforced are the licensing requirements? The second most important one was ease of complying with a tax code, which we found actually mattered a lot more than tax rates. Mm. The tax code was actually, the ability for a professional to understand the tax code and file his or her taxes easily was actually quite important. And the third most important category that determined perceptions of overall friendliness was one that actually surprised me, and it was the availability of training and networking programs. So if a city or a state offers a program to help a professional understand how to start his business, understand what the rules of the road are in complying with regulations, understand how to meet other people in the industry and, you know, how to price things and stuff like that. That turned out to be pretty important for determining overall perceptions of friendliness.
What were the strongest points for small businesses in Phoenix?
Phoenix did quite well in zoning regulations. You guys got an A-, which puts you towards the top of the heap in zoning. And you also did well in licensing, which, as I mentioned earlier, was actually one of the most important determinants of overall friendliness. So it looks like Phoenix is doing regulations pretty well. It isn't imposing too many burdens on folks. There's always, of course, room for improvement.
How did male small business owners feel compared to female small business owners?
I was really surprised by this. It turns out that across the country, there's a statistically significant difference in the feelings towards local government amongst men small business owners and female small business owners. Female small business owners in general tend to either feel more positively about local government or are more forgiving of local government. So we found that the general scores given by women entrepreneurs were higher than the general scores given by men. Now, the flip side of that, and for reasons that I don't quite understand, men entrepreneurs were more likely to say that the state business climate where they operate, the economic environment, meaning like growth and the potential for growth, was better than female entrepreneurs. So men a little more optimistic about the future of the economy, women a little more forgiving and happier with the state of government regulations.
That's Thumbtack Chief Economist John Lieber.
So just how small business friendly are Phoenix and Arizona? Farrell Quinlan says more friendly than they were. He's the state director for the National Federation of Independent Business.
I think Phoenix has taken a lot of strides to appeal to small businesses and having them have a expedited permitting process to set up. I mean, we're trying to really clear the way for new business startups and to make it easy.
So Phoenix and Arizona have each gotten better in their rankings. Phoenix went from a C-plus last year to a B this year in overall rankings. Arizona did the same. Does that kind of jibe with what your members are saying about things maybe improving?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not sure what a C or a B means, but you see the trend line. In terms of things improving, I think that's true. We have not seen any significant increases in taxation at the state level and on the city level. In fact, there was actually the retirement of the Prop 100 one-cent sales tax, which relieved some of the burden on sales. And like I said, some of the innovative ideas are coming out of the city council. About 24-hour permitting, self-certification of architects and engineers' plans. So I think the trend line from a C to a B is correct, and hopefully that will continue.
One of the areas in which both the state and the city of Phoenix got dinged a little bit was in regulation, environmental regulation, other kinds of regulations. Do your members talk about the kinds of regulations they face? Because it seems like the state has done a lot to try to stop passing new regulations and try to roll back some of the ones that were already in existence.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a persistent issue with regulations. It's not just in Phoenix or in the state of Arizona, but I think nationwide. What we've found, and we've been working on this in the legislature, and we'll be doing so again in 2015, is there's this, people like to call it sometimes regulatory bullying. So we've been working to try to make sure that the due process rights of small business owners are respected by the regulators, and so that the regulatory framework we have is actually facilitating commerce and not impeding it.
So two of Arizona's neighbors, New Mexico and California, both got ratings worse than Arizona. California got an F rating and New Mexico got a D plus. Some of Arizona's other neighbors, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, and Texas, did better than Arizona. When you look at the region, what do you make of sort of where Arizona fits into the rankings from some of its neighboring states?
Yeah, I think the stratification there is kind of true. Everyone seems to think California is very oppressive, and Texas and Nevada are quite go-go and pro-business.
Farrell Quinlan is the state director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Farrell, thanks.
Thank you.
Arizona, along with many parts of the U.S., is experiencing the worst drought in decades. Farmers are warning that harvests are being badly hit. Oklahoma has endured persistent drought for the past 3.5 years, and people there are fearful of a return to the Dust Bowl conditions of the 1930s. The BBC's David Shookman sent this report from the Oklahoma Panhandle.
I'm walking over the baked surface of what looks like a sand dune beside a vast field. And after a drought that's gone on and off for 3.5 years, the soils here are so parched that whenever the wind picks up, as it is now, it can lift the dry soils as dust and just dump them often miles away. Well, here, the dust has accumulated so deeply that it's almost buried a barbed wire fence that I can see stretching for miles into the distance. The conditions almost reminiscent of those that afflicted the 1930s with the infamous Dust Bowl. People here are getting worried.
I've seen droughts, but probably not anything as devastating as we've had the last 2 or 3 years.
J.B. Stewart and his son Jared own this farm. Jared is the fifth generation on this land. Some of their fields will produce no grain at all this summer, and they want to show me what the drought means, how their silos are unlikely to be filled this year.
So let's take a look.
This is some of last year.
This particular silo is about half full.
Right, so you're lowering the light, because there's obviously no light in there.
Right,
no.
It's right. Dark, it's just a tube.
I'm not seeing anything yet.
There you go, you're starting to see some grain now.
It's about 50 feet to the grain.
And these are approximately 100 foot tall.
In a good year, this would be what? Brimming?
Yes, full, and full. All the other bins around.
All stuff full. In a bad year, what happens?
You save last year's crop so you have something to plant.
Because you're literally not expecting to add much this year.
No, very little.
A catastrophe of frightening proportions gripped America's main agricultural belt.
Conditions have now stirred memories of the infamous Dust Bowl in the 1930s. Huge storms stripped the soil from the fields, and writers like John Steinbeck captured the plight of the people. The nightmare was seared in the national memory. There was hardly any rainfall, and there's only been slightly more in the past few years. Lunchtime in the Rockin' A Diner in Boys City. I'm with a survivor of the Dust Bowl, Millard Fowler, who's 101 years old and remembers the suffering of those times.
The Dust Bowl was in combination with the Depression. Caused a lot of people to leave the country, and there was quite a few suicides. All 50, 60 years old that had worked all their life and they lose everything, it's pretty hard on them. And there were a lot of suicides.
So the big question is whether droughts in this region will become more intense as the climate changes. Well, I've come to the University of Oklahoma. I'm standing beside a collection of instruments measuring different aspects of the weather. And with me is Dr. Renee McPherson, who was one of the authors on the recent National Climate Assessment. She focused on the Great Plains region. Renee, what can you say about what's likely to happen to drought in the future?
We feel very sure that temperatures will increase into the mid-century and late on into the end of the century.
So that could make a drought worse, whatever happens to the rainfall.
Yes, this effect of drying the soils through our increased temperatures will impact our drought conditions.
People hearing this might say, well, in the 1930s, there was the terrible Dust Bowl that affected thousands of people long before anyone suggested a thing called man-made global warming. What would you answer them with?
In this area of the country, in the southern Great Plains, we do have drought that occurs as part of the regular variability in our climate, and we expect that that will continue. But what climate change does is it puts additional stresses on the system.
This land, repeatedly scarred by drought, has seen whole generations leave. And the talk now is of learning to cope with what could be tougher times ahead.
That's the BBC's David Shookman.
It's the show. I'm Kendra Sabo. I produce some of the audio vignettes you hear each week, and these are the sounds of the city.
Three,
My name is John Rankin, and I'm out watching fireworks with my family. We brought the little kid out, got everything set up, got a blanket. We're seeing how he reacts. He's a year and a half old. The last one he doesn't remember, so we're going to see what happens with this one. We live about a half mile away, so it's perfect for us. It's nice having stuff up in North Phoenix. Most things are down in South Phoenix or in the Central, you know. We kind of like food trucks and stuff like that. We're seeing what they have to offer out here at the park. I lived all over the country, and they always have something different to offer. I like it here in Phoenix, though. The summer nights are really nice. It's not too cold, and the sun's gone. It's not too hot.
That's John Rankin watching fireworks with his family at the Deer Valley Park in North Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix, well, Phoenix, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Coming up on the show, we'll visit a house in the valley that's a replica of a 60s TV favorite.
It was a set at Paramount, and that was started in 1959, and in 1962, they started building this house.
It's a bonanza in Mesa. That's later on the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Hope you're having a happy 4th of July. Nothing to report in Valley traffic at this hour, but could have some potential busy weather this evening, like we did last night. Looking for a 30% chance for rain tonight and blowing dust a little bit later on. Expect overnight lows to be in the mid-80s, and then for tomorrow, a chance for rain at a high of 104. It's currently partly cloudy and 93 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Across Arizona Tours, providing daily sightseeing tours for individuals and corporate groups. Tour descriptions, rates, and tour guide profiles at AcrossArizonaTours.com. A member of Local First Arizona.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Nothing quite says 4th of July like a perfectly grilled hot dog, or 61. Today, competitive eater Joey Chestnut won the Nathan's hot dog eating contest with more than 5 dozen hot dogs.
Still, many of us who are content with one or two will fire up the grill sometime today.
John Hockenberry talks with Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, about the best way to cook them and how exactly hot dogs wound up an iconic American tradition.
Hot dogs have been an integral part of the American backyard barbecue for a long, long time. In fact, this year we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Hot Dog Summit. Back in 1939, Hitler storming across Germany, and the Brits and the Americans, the leaders of the two countries, are kind of realizing, you know, we might need to team up here. But in the U.S., people weren't crazy about the Brits. FDR says, I got to warm up my people to the Brits. So he invited King George and the Queen across the Atlantic, their first time a sitting monarch ever set foot on U.S. soil. And he had a picnic and he fed them hot dogs. And the headline in the New York Times the next day blared, King eats hot dogs, asks for more. And the American people said, the king and queen aren't so bad after all.
The hot dog is not like a sausage in the sense that it has a skin and there's raw meat inside. Hot dogs are pre-cooked. Do you have a best brand, a safe brand? They've got all different kinds. They've got, you know, Fearless hot dogs, which are supposedly grass-fed, organic or something. I mean, your normal hot dog is a pretty processed piece of meat there.
That's true. I mean, to me, the first thing you're looking for is a natural casing. The natural casing is what takes a hot dog to another level. You know, a lot of people grill hot dogs, and they tell me, well, I like it grilled because I like the crisp that it gives the outside of the hot dog.
You always say that.
No, I actually would argue that hot dogs are better boiled or steamed.
So forget the crisp.
Well, because if you have a natural casing, you get a toothsome textural experience that is unique.
Toothsome textural experience.
That's what we call it.
All right. So where do you stand on split open, not split open cooking hot dogs? Because if you grill them too long, they split open always. And little kids like my 4-year-old will say, I don't want to eat that. It's broken.
I think that you don't want it split open. I mean, why do you want to pierce the skin and lose juice? You're going to get juice loss. That's not a good thing.
So don't over grill.
Right.
Don't over boil.
Right.
keep it intact.
That's right. And people need to realize, as you said, John, it's already cooked. So all you're doing is heating it.
Condiments, my friend?
I do like condiments, but I recommend that people not apply condiments directly to their hot dogs, because then you can get over-condimentation. You also then, you're locked in to whatever condiments you have there. I recommend dipping the hot dog on a per-bite basis into different condiments. Then you can do a little ketchup, little mustard, combo, cheese sauce, mayo, what have you.
That's sriracha. It's a whole platter you have to carry around with yourself.
Well, look, you could spread it on in little one-inch increments, right. but I like ratio management as I go through the dog. You don't know what kind of mood's going to strike you when you're halfway through a hot dog, John.
Dan Pashman of the Sporkville Podcast. Happy 4th of July. Happy hot dog 4th of July.
Thanks, you too, John.
Don't stuff yourself.
Hot dogs. Don't you know that you gotta
eat? That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
If you're shopping for a new sofa this summer and you go to IKEA, you may leave with a new puppy, too.
The Arizona Humane Society has partnered with IKEA Tempe to launch a pilot program featuring adoptable pets. As you walk through the showroom, there are cardboard cutouts of dogs and cats displayed among kitchen furniture and dorm room displays.
Each cutout has a tag on it with a QR code, and that QR code goes right back to our adoptable pet pages.
That's Bretta Nelson. She's the public relations manager at the Humane Society. The program started at the IKEA in Singapore, but the Tempe store is the first one in the U.S. to feature the adoptable pets. The cutouts will be featured for the entire summer, showing unsuspecting shoppers just how cute they could be shedding on your new furniture.
And those are people that, you know, weren't necessarily looking to adopt that day, but right when it was there kind of in front of them, it gave them that little nudge.
Social media has been key to the success so far, says Becky Blaine. She's the PR manager at IKEA Tempe. She says it's helped tie the launch to the city.
Just being able to work with a local community organization in this way, I think it's a win-win for everybody.
While all of the pets on display in the store were adopted the first week of the program, the Humane Society's website is updated hourly.
So buyer beware, your renovated kitchen may come complete with a fluffy kitten. Four years ago, one of the most historic free agent signings in NBA history happened when LeBron James made this announcement.
The answer to the question everybody wants to know. LeBron, what's your decision?
In this fall, man, it's very tough. In this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
James is again on the free market this offseason, and many Phoenix Suns fans are hoping to hear James say something like this.
In this fall, I'm going to take my talents to
Phoenix and play for the Suns. And after a surprisingly good 2013-2014 season, the Suns are diving in the big pool by saying they are pursuing James. Bob Young, Arizona Republic sports columnist, has covered the Suns for decades and says acquiring James would be the biggest move the team has ever made, even beyond their 1992 trade for Charles Barkley.
Even Charles, when he came, it was just, he probably wasn't in the prime of his career, but he was very close to it. But he hadn't won an MVP title yet. He hadn't played in the NBA Finals. And, LeBron is, I think, arguably one of the top, three players of all time. Charles, I think, would have been the highest profile player they brought in. That was via trade. This would be a whole different level.
Does it surprise you that it's even being speculated on, considering how last year's team was so much, it seemed like a group of underdogs and a group of surprising players?
I think one of the strongest points that the Suns have to offer is that they're pretty good without LeBron James. I think you could make the argument that had Eric Bledsoe been available for the whole season, instead of, half of it, essentially, and they would have made the playoffs. So, you could argue that this is a playoff team just with the roster it has now in the Western Conference, which is a much tougher conference. So I think that, if you're LeBron, the attraction is, hey, I can go there, they can give me the maximum contract I want, and they don't have to give up anything. They don't have to move players out of there to make room for me.
What are you watching most closely, Bob, to see whether this is just like a 1 in a million chance or, maybe a 1 in a thousand chance?
I don't know if I'd say 1 in a million. I do think what's going to have to happen is things are going to have to fall apart with Miami. Because let's face it, for all the talk about, he doesn't want to leave Miami and he's got a comfort level there and You know, they can put some new players around him. Well, you know, they got rid of some of the guys that he wanted on that team after their second championship.
Bob, how about off the court? Would Phoenix be ready? Obviously the fans would, but as far as the media market, from that standpoint, do you think this place would work off the court for him?
Yeah, the reason I do is because it doesn't really matter what market he lives in. He's one of those guys that rises above whatever market he's in. He's already making tons of money through endorsements. It's not like these companies are going to start saying, hey, you know, you're in too small of a market, we're dropping you. The guy's going to be marketable no matter where he's at. And so, yeah, I don't think it's a factor at all anymore. Once upon a time, it would have been. But nowadays, I don't think it matters at all.
Arizona Republic and AZ Central sports columnist Bob Young. The Suns are supposed to find out within the next week or so whether they've landed James.
It's like having your own movie set right here in the Valley. A famous television house was replicated more than 50 years ago in Mesa. Its creation helped lure well-known television stars and new residents to the area. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more about it.
It was among the longest-running westerns on television in the 1960s. Bonanza was the story of a single father and three sons living in an 1860s Nevada ranch called the Ponderosa. The city of Mesa has a replica of the famous Tahoe-style cabin home. Did you know Lorne Greene built Ponderosa, too, as a marketing tool?
This was a flagship home to advertise Apache Country Club, which Lorne Greene had invested in.
Louise Swan and her husband Tom are huge fans of Bonanza and call themselves the proud owners of Ponderosa, too. The house is a cross between a livable home and a museum.
And so Lorne built this house to attract people to come here and build houses and buy lots.
The only sections of the Ponderosa often seen on the show were the living room, dining room, and patriarch Ben Cartwright's office. This home is exactly like the television house. A set of horns hangs over a massive stone fireplace in the living room. Adjacent to it is the large rifle case and the stairs that lead to a second floor. The dining room table is situated the same as it was in the show.
It was a set at Paramount, and that was started in 1959, and then in 1962, they started building this house. So it was only 3 years after
the start. As we walk through the house, husband Tom Swan tells me the history of this iconic house. He says it was a challenge for developers to turn a television set into a livable home. When completed, it was a nearly 4,000-square-foot house on a half-acre lot next to a golf course.
We were told it cost $100,000 to build this house in 1963. And I did a reverse calculator online, and it came at over $700,000 today.
Lorne Greene got permission from the show's creator to build it. He added two bedrooms, an Arizona room with a bar, and a large patio. The Swans say Ponderosa 2 was Lorne Greene's getaway home. The cast of Bonanza even came to the Valley for a housewarming party. In 1967, Greene sold it. That owner lived here for 40 years. When the Swans learned it was for sale, they bought it and used old photos to assure everything in the house is true to the show.
Everything in here is ours that we've purchased to add to the look. So the house is pure 1960s, but the inside is pure 1860s.
The Swans are organizing a 2015 Bonanza fan gathering in Mesa. This house will be among the locations where evening social events will take place. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
Since 2009, the official six seasons of Bonanza have been released on DVD in the U.S., and official season 7 is being released on September 2nd. If you've got ideas or suggestions that make Phoenix unique, or you just like old TV westerns, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
If you want to join 50,000 of your closest friends to check out some fireworks tonight, Tempe Beach Park could be your place. Steve Barnes with Fireworks Productions of Arizona, though, says when it comes to shells, size matters.
The difference in sizes of shell are how big the effect is in the air, how big it breaks, and then how high it flies. So basically, for every inch It goes 100 feet.
And for the record, Barnes says Tempe show will use 5-inch shells, so, you know, you can do the math.
The show was produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Kendra Sabo, and Caitlin Stein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. The managing editor is Al Macias. News director, Peter O'Dowd. Executive producer, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. Send us your fireworks photos at the show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.